Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program today a good friend who hasn't been on the show in a little bit of time, Terry Schultz, a Brussels-based journalist who reports for both Deutsche Welle and National Public Radio. She's one of the finest reporters covering international security, Europe, and of course, NATO. Terry, thanks so very much for joining us, and it's a pleasure having you back on.
Oh, thank you so much, Vago. I am blushing in the online sphere here that we're sharing, so your listeners can't tell, but I am. Thank you for that very kind introduction.
Thank you very much. You're a terrific reporter, and you used to be a regular on our Washington Roundtable, and it's terrific talking to you again. Before we get started, a quick word that the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Terry, again, great to have you back on the program, and we know how busy you are. Last week, news broke that you reported extraordinarily well, I will point out, that a years-long Czech intelligence investigation revealed the extraordinary Russian campaign to co-opt EU parliamentarians and sort of spread disinformation and discord across Europe to undermine the EU, undermine NATO and the Atlantic Alliance, and indeed Europeans' trust in their own organizations. The Belgian Prime Minister, Alex de Croo, said that it was imperative for Belgium to play a leading role in this, as Brussels is home to both the EU as well as NATO. Walk us through what we know about what the Czechs uncovered and really what was so revealing about it.
Well, that's a good intro, Vago, but it doesn't span what we know so far, because it wasn't just the Czechs, it was also Belgian security that were investigating this, and also Polish security. And this one plan that you mentioned, this propaganda network Voice of Europe that was discovered in Prague, wasn't the only prong that Russia had here trying to influence European Union parliamentarians. So Voice of Europe was a network set up and run by actually a Ukrainian friend of Vladimir Putin's, who's now been sanctioned by the Czech government. And it's basically, I mean, you can still look at it online because it's moved to Kazakhstan. And it's basically a fake news network. It has fake correspondents. It may even have some real people who were acting as reporters. And I'm not sure co-opt is the right word, because it seems that some of these European parliamentarians went on voluntarily, and we presume that they were paid. This is part of the allegations that are now under investigation, because they gave interviews to this network saying things like, you know, that they hoped Ukraine would lose, that the European Union and NATO shouldn't help Ukraine anymore in the war. And they seemed to be there of their own volition. So co-opting may be too kind to them,
or there were plants, right? I mean, there were worries that some of these EU parliamentarians have had longtime links to Russian intelligence.
Exactly.
As you said, this is one prong of a multifaceted Russian campaign.
That's right. I mean, so the Voice of Europe was one part of it, but they also found that some EU parliamentarians may have been taking cash directly without the Voice of Europe intermediary. What had happened last week, and the reason why you and I discussed that we should definitely talk about this, is because the European Parliament, in its last voting session of its five-year mandate, passed this really incredibly long resolution calling for stricter controls and mentioning some of these lawmakers by name, and even pointing out how much money they're accused of taking. And one of them who's mentioned more than once is Maximilian Krah. He's with the AfD, far right party in Germany. He apparently has even been questioned by the FBI about taking cash from the Kremlin. So that's maybe of interest to U.S. listeners. And he became particularly interesting even as this resolution was being debated and being authored, because on the day that it was going to be voted, or I think it was the day before, actually, one of his aides was arrested, but he was charged with being a Chinese agent. It's not just Russia at all. There have been other influence scandals in the European Parliament over the last a couple of years of also very high ranking lawmakers taking money from Qatar, alleged to be taking money from Qatar, from Morocco, from other countries that definitely would like to have more friendly EU laws passed toward them. So, yeah, I mean, there are more than 700 parliamentarians in the European Parliament. So perhaps it's not surprising just statistically that some of them aren't going to be, you know, have the best characters.
And do we know how many of them are under the thrall or the thumb, right, sort of more directly of Russian intelligence?
We don't know. Some of them are mentioned by name, and it's not only sitting parliamentarians. One of the other concerns, and this is laid out in this resolution that the EP passed, is that there have also been allegations of candidates. Again, one particular guy running for the AFD, who are alleged to be taking money and to be, you know, fomenting disinformation campaigns themselves to spread, you know, falsehoods ahead of European Union elections, which are June 6th through the 9th. The next 5-year mandate of the European Parliament will have a big impact on what the European Union does to help Ukraine, which is of a very significant interest to Russia. So, yeah, this is and another thing I'll mention is that as we are, one of the reasons why actually I was working right up to this recording is that just today, the European Commission has opened an investigation against Facebook and Instagram, against Meta, alleging that the company is not doing what it's supposed to under EU regulations to stop disinformation being spread on its platforms, on Facebook and Instagram. They have obligations under EU law to pull down illegal content, to stop the spreading of disinformation. There's a very special Russian technique called the doppelganger technique, in which legitimate news sites are mimicked. I mean, The Guardian, this has happened to The Guardian. So they create websites that look exactly like the legitimate news site, put fake articles on them, and set up links to them. And people don't know that they're reading false information because they have so accurately, you know, created these pages that look like the original website. And the EU says, look, you, Meta, you have 5 days to get back to us on how you're going to fix this.
I think it's really extraordinary. And I think as much as we talk about weapons, the most destructive weapon is information and the misuse of information in the hands of malign actors.
Absolutely.
I want to go into a little bit more of the mechanics, right? I mean, is this really coming as a surprise? Because some of the names of people that are being mentioned, there are folks like us who cover this regularly who are like, well, that doesn't seem like a surprise, but it is sort of confirmation, if you will, right? I mean, whether it's you know, somebody in the Baltics who, you know, always seem to be hewing to a particularly Russian line. There's a prominent a member of European Parliament who's Latvian, who's mentioned in this. I mean, does this come as a surprise really to anybody? Or sort of a confirmation, right? Better late than never, always. But, you know, I mean, is anybody genuinely surprised by this?
This Latvian EU lawmaker that you mentioned, Tatiana Tsardanova, she was well known to be sympathetic to Russia because she openly spoke this way on, you know, on the floor of the European Parliament. She was thrown out of the Greens years ago for this. But look at this. Her fine was less than $2,000. Her fine for having illegitimate communications and receiving gifts that she didn't announce as she is supposed to, that she didn't record. It was fined less than $2,000. So, you know, if you're getting a bunch of money from Moscow, I don't think that's much of a deterrent. So that seems a little silly to me. And yeah, that one wasn't a surprise, but she's not running again. She would not be reelected in Latvia. I think what they're as worried about is that particularly as the far right is doing so well in polling ahead of European elections, that you could have this Maximilian Krah from the AfD, the AfD, who now himself, by the way, is under investigation, not just his aide, that he could get reelected, and that then that he can, you know, help help direct policy inside the parliament. And these are votes on like funding, like I said, funding for Ukraine, for, you know, encouraging joint procurement, the kinds of things that your listeners right. would be interested in. And I think that if more people like that, who are already under suspicion, get elected despite this, I think that's what's frightening, is actually the lack of outrage by the public, I think, is a big worry for those who, you know, would very much like to see these people singled out and removed from the campaigns. But that's not happening at the moment. They're still allowed to run, and they may well get elected.
Well, I mean, as we've seen, right? I mean, unfortunately, Marine Le Pen, who is increasingly in position to take the French presidency, as Emmanuel Macron can't run, and it's a debate about whether or not his party is going to be able to succeed. She was a Russian project. She got money from the Russians. She claims that she's paid it all back. But these kind of operations are successful, aren't they? I mean, at the end of the day.
You know, people are allowed to support Russia. That's part of the democratic range of opinion. But I think that it should be known. And to be fair, I mean, Marine Le Pen hasn't been secretive about her sympathy for Russia, and you know, she's spoken openly about it. So I think that what people who are afraid of this kind of thing would like to see is public education and media literacy and those kind of things, so that people at least would have the facts. And if they then decide that they want European leaders who are in cahoots with the Kremlin, then okay, that's what we're going to have. But I think the fear is that people don't understand this. My fear as a journalist, and having seen just the decline of trust and the decline of respect for expertise, is that they even will know this and won't care. Right. So I think that, you know, without taking sides, or, you know, although in the case of the Ukraine-Russia war, you know, I don't think it's easy to be neutral. There may well be enough people who believe that Russia should be allowed to win this war, that, you know, you're going to see a lot of those people elected in June.
Well, and the Russians, right, make a compelling narrative. We have health care problems here. Our money should be staying here. Why is all this money going to help Ukrainians? They're Nazis after all, right? And so, I mean, it's a message that for many Europeans who are grappling with potential cuts to medical care and everything else are saying, wow, you know, aren't we spending a lot of money on weapons? And, you know, this is a problem for the Russians, right? It's a powerful narrative that's even affected American politics, right? I mean, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, a Republican's Republican, is accusing his party of being Moscow's useful idiots. Let me take you to some of the more specific things that we're also uncovering in the course of this investigation. Walk us through how a couple in the Czech Republic have been so instrumental in everything from, right, I mean, we've talked about information operations, but Czech and Bulgarian ammunition, you know, they've been implicated in the destruction of Czech and Bulgarian ammunition depots, the poisoning of a Bulgarian weapons factory owner, plus running a hideout in Greece for the GRU Unit 29155, which is sort of their, but, you know, whether it's in the information space or others elsewhere, I think they're involved in the, you know, microwave energy attacks on American diplomats, right? Walk us through how this immigrant Russian couple, whose husband apparently has suddenly died of alcoholism, apparently, and not taking his medication. It may not have been a natural expiration. You know, walk us through that story, which is just incredible.
Well, this is not any of my original reporting, Vaga, so I wouldn't want to take any credit for that. I just uncovered it as I was reminding myself of the details of, that you and I were going to speak about. And this is something that's just come out in the last day or so. But it says the Czechs have been investigating this at the same time as they were looking into, you know, Voice of Europe and influence on European parliamentarians. But yeah, this is quite a remarkable story about this former Russian officer named Nikolai Shaposhnikov and his wife. But apparently living in the Czech Republic, they worked for years to help them try to sabotage the EU. And as you mentioned, some of those events that, you know, would have made news. I mean, do you remember when those ammo factories were blown up?
I do.
And, you know, yeah, this was quite odd. And remember, this is not mentioned in the article, but this was happening at the same time, sort of around the same time that, you know, people were found, Russians were found trying to spy on international institutions in The Hague, at the same time as the poisonings were taking place of the Skripals. So all of this, you know, may be linked. I've only seen this, the beginning of these articles that are going to come out. And, you know, that they seem to have lived quite a good life there in the Czech Republic. And they have since left and, you know, refused to give information to the Czech authorities when they started to get onto them. But, you know, they moved in and out quite freely on Russian passports. And, you know, I think we're going to see more. These investigations are usually, we usually find out, you know, a lot of really intriguing details by some of these really excellent OSINT reporters. You know, Bellingcat and those guys usually, you know, get us all the details on that. But this story has just broken. I've just seen it myself. So, you know, I'm not sure everything that we know about that. But it seems that Russian infiltrators have lived quite comfortable lives in Europe. And we know that from the fact that the oligarchs still are living just fine in London and other places, you know, sort of immune from sanctions.
I find it interesting that the couple had a hotel in northern Greece where they were giving apparently safe cover to this elite Russian unit. Let me take you to the question of, right, I mean, there will be many, many more revelations. But as you noted, this is something where in sort of elite intellectual circles, people are talking about. It's not abundantly clear whether the rank and file folks on the street in Europe, you would have a better answer to this than I would. What are European leaders doing about this? What can they do about this? You've said that some of these are slaps on the wrist. It's a 2,000 euro fine. If mm-hmm. you're Russian intelligence and helping a Czech couple buy a resort, you know, or a hotel in northern Greece, $2,000's probably not that big of an ask. How are European leaders finding this? And I should point out to our audience that Nigel Inkster of the International Institute for Strategic Studies is going to be joining us tomorrow to discuss a little bit about how to better counter some of these information operations. But from your standpoint, what are European officials doing about this?
Well, the problem for European leaders when they're asked about this is that these are really matters of what are called national competence. The EU can't do anything about individuals. It can, as the European Parliament has done, pass a resolution saying that we don't like this and that you should do more to, weed out bad apples before they become policymakers. But these are things that national governments have to do. And the EU doesn't have anything that they can do about it. One thing I would, because the European Commission will be rejuggled in after elections, and it remains to be seen whether European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen is in charge. She probably will be, but you know she doesn't have a lot that she can say because again, it's up to member states to pass the laws on this. But one of the things that the European Parliament would like the current parliament to pass before they're completely gone with these June elections is that there would have to be background checks on anybody handling confidential information inside the parliament. Right now, there's no such thing. So anybody can come in as an aide, like this guy working for Maximilian Krah, who was allegedly a Chinese agent. And they can work on the security and defense issues. So they can get access to this data, and it's very easy to pass it on. I get, you know, leaked resolutions, you know, all the time. So does every other journalist. So it's not hard to get this information. So it says in this resolution that they want anybody handling this kind of data to have a background check. And, you know, we all know that that doesn't, you know, that doesn't mean that these people have ethics that will prevent them from passing on the data that they get to. But it's hoped that, you couldn't be somebody that's had problems like this before, or maybe you get nervous and, you know, you don't go for those kind of jobs. But that's about all you can do at a European level to sort of block them from coming into the institutions. Otherwise, this is all at member state level.
You cover NATO very closely, Terry. What are we hearing from NATO officials, right? Because if the Russians are penetrating, the EU, they're going to, you know, it's pretty clear they're no friend of, NATO either. And so as easily could be doing these kinds of operations to shape NATO and where NATO ends up, even though one is a military organization, there are counterintelligence folks that are part of it. But what sense are you getting from NATO officials about whether they have a similar problem?
Well, this gives me a chance to explain to people something that they might find very interesting. And that is when I first started covering NATO back in 2007, the Russians were allowed, the Russians had a mission there. They had their own NATO office that was next to the Swedes, next to the Finns, next to the Georgians, next to other countries who were Partnership for Peace countries. And they could walk around the entire premises without any escorts. I mean, they had more access than I would have. As a journalist, for sure, you could have meetings in the Russian mission. They ate in the cafeteria with everybody else. That's how good, I mean, in retrospect, relations were at that time. And then after Georgia in 2008, some of their access was taken away a little bit. And then gradually, as relations deteriorated, finally, a few years ago, Belgium kicked out a bunch of the Russians at NATO and said, look, they are engaging in activities that are not, not diplomatic. We think they're spies. They failed to renew. They wouldn't renew their diplomatic visas. And so Russia got angry and it left NATO altogether. It had this mission for, decades. And then Russia said, well, you know what? We're not going to be here at all, which was probably better for NATO because there were allegations that, there were devices, listening devices in there. There was a big scandal about them possibly spying electronically while they were there. So now there is no Russian access to NATO headquarters and not meetings with Russians anymore like there used to be. So I think that NATO is probably less penetrable by people. Of course, they're hacked multiple times every day, or there's attempts to hack them. The cyber attacks, the hybrid attacks are just constant on NATO. And of course, on every member state, because this is true in the EU as well, but any country that's a NATO member or an EU member has the same information or has access to NATO systems. So if you hack the weakest one, the one with the most penetrable cyber security, then you've got access to everybody else's information as well. So that's a big concern, and it has led those countries with more robust systems and more concern about confidential data to share less with NATO. And this has been one of the problems when they want to increase sharing of information. The countries with the most to lose always point out that there are weaker links. And that's a big concern.
Indeed, the alliance is only as strong as its weakest link. Let me ask you one last question. NATO already marked its 75th anniversary as the world's most successful political and military alliance, even as its summit will be in July in Washington, we're told in part because of a apparently unfortunate scheduling error. What is the sense of what's going to get accomplished, Terry? You've been watching this at a high political level for a long time. The Ukrainians want some track to getting in. Indeed, it was in 2008 when the Bush administration proposed Georgia and Ukraine entering NATO that sort of enraged the Russians. Now there's talk, a lot of people make the case, hey, West Germany was divided at the time that it was allowed to join NATO. Then again, there was also no hot war going on right between East and West Germany. It was a Cold War. What's the sense of the direction we're going in and alliance unity? Right. I mean, everybody does seem to be coming together to try to help Ukraine, even if, you know, and try to keep making the case why it's important to help Ukraine. What's the sense on what's going to get accomplished at this summit that's coming up that's not just going to be awkward and highlight fissures in the alliance, for example, over Ukraine?
There is going to be some awkwardness, I think, because Ukraine is not going to be offered membership. It knows that. It's been told over and over and over again that it's not going to be offered membership. But the alliance is trying to come up with what it calls reassurance measures to try to draw Ukraine as close as it can get unity on without offering it membership. So they're working on what that package will look like for Ukraine. It has to do with persistent funding. And that's one of the reasons why NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg has raised the idea of this 100 billion euro fund, although he didn't make clear where he's going to get the money. And has also talked about taking over the Ramstein group, the sort of weapons generation meeting that was started by the U.S. That has taken place every month now for most of the last 2 years. And that putting that under NATO auspices rather than leaving it to potentially, unfriendly administration in Washington to do that is considered something that would be reassuring for Ukraine. It would give continuity to put it under NATO. And again, this 100 billion euro fund, nobody knows where he expected the money to come from, but it's a sign that they are quite desperate to show Ukraine that that NATO support will be there. But I think that what Ukraine cares about really is the recent aid package that finally got passed there in Washington, the permission for F-16s to be sent from European allies to Ukraine. These are the things that Ukraine counts on day to day. The ammunition supplies that we're going to see coming through the Czech and already are being delivered through the Czech initiative and through the European Union. These are the things that matter on the ground. And these are the things that Ukraine will want to see very, very grounded at the Washington summit. But there's no way it's not going to be a disappointment for Ukraine there. It's going to be it's going to be difficult. What can you offer Ukraine that would be, would be the equivalent of Article 5? Absolutely nothing.
Terry, thanks so very much for joining us. We know how busy you are. Look forward to seeing you either in Brussels or here in Washington. Thanks so very much and keep up the absolutely terrific work.
Thank you for having me, Vago. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. As I mentioned, we'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, hope everybody has a great day. Thanks very much.